There's a lot of talk about trade these days, but the nitty-gritty of importing and exporting has always been a little hard to conceptualize. Take this old clip from Seinfeld, for example.
We're meeting a friend of ours for lunch, works here in the building.
Yeah, Art Vandelay.
Which company?
I don't know. He's an importer.
Importer.
And exporter.
He's an importer, exporter.
Well, we're not going to get much clarity on trade from that sitcom. So I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll find out what Kansas City imports and exports and whether we will be affected by Trump's promise to get tough on international trade. We'll have experts on trade to help put deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership in context. But first, let's find out a little bit about the life of an actual importer-exporter. Kevin Ekstrand is with us from Scarborough International. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
So you import and export.
Well, we help facilitate companies that do import and export. So we're kind of that middle person that moves the cargo and handles the regulatory aspects of it for all the great companies here in the Midwest.
Describe what that role is a little bit more. I mean, how do you facilitate the moving of cargo?
Well, kind of as, on the import side of things, you know, we kind of do two things. We act kind of as the travel agent for cargo. So as cargo, if someone wants to move, import something, say, from the UK, United Kingdom to Kansas City here, we contract to put that on a container, on a ship, moved across the ocean, and put on a train where it comes into our intermodal hub here in Kansas City, gets offloaded. And in the meantime, we're also handling the regulatory aspect of it, which is kind of like being a tax accountant, handling, making sure that duties and taxes are paid.
So you're like, you make an itinerary for stuff.
Yeah, virtually.
Tell me the story of an item that you have helped move for someone in Kansas City, an import, for example, or just in our area.
Just in our area, just any type of example.
Yeah.
Well, we're in a building here. I used to have a client right down here. They were a bunch of engineers that used to work for Garmin, and they spun off and created their own Bluetooth speaker. And so that they designed and the speaker, and they had it manufactured in China, and contracted with us. We helped them facilitate, figure out what the land of cost would be, how much is it going to cost to get it from, say, Shanghai, China, where we have an office, all the way into Kansas City. So facilitating the move. They contact us when they're ready to ship. We then, in turn, contact with their factory. Their factory gives us all the details. We schedule a container to show up at their factory. They load the container. And then we have contracted with carriers, the big steamship lines around the world, to put that on a steamship line and move that, say, to L.A. It's roughly a 14-day transit to Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, it gets off the boat and it gets onto a train. And once that usually happens on a Friday, it departs on a Monday for Kansas City, and it's roughly 4.5 days on the rail to Kansas City. And during that process, we're handling the regulatory aspects. So we're communicating with U.S. Customs as it relates to what is actually being imported, and say a Bluetooth speaker, so to speak. That also requires other government agencies, such as the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. So we're transmitting data to that agency as well. And in so, we're get releases from those agencies that say it's okay to enter the commerce of the U.S. And at that point, it arrives, we get it unloaded, have a truck deliver it to their facility where they unload the container, and then we have that container taken back to a yard. So we're handling the communications with multiple government agencies. The FCC would just be one.
So that's like a manufactured good. I'm curious how that might be different with, say, an agricultural product. I mean, when I think sort of the history of import and export, the history of trade, mm-hmm. that some of the earliest stuff is just like, I want to eat something that I can't get a hold of where I live. And I hear that there's someone in Lawrence who imports dates.
Yeah, we've got a client that imports dates out of Pakistan. Same kind of thing, an FDA product. So for a situation like that, the same thing. They've got to get that product from Pakistan. It comes up through the canals, usually comes through New York and then into Kansas City. And so for that specific commodity, you know, we're looking at and again, another government agency that's protecting the food supply of the United States, that's the FDA. So while U.S. Customs has their own regulations and laws, they also enforce over 400 laws from other government agencies as well.
What is it that our food supply is being protected from?
Oh, it's just from any contaminants, salmonella, those kinds of things, E. coli, those kinds of things. So in that process, USDA often gets involved as well. They can request that these goods be examined, tested, before they can be delivered on to the final consumer.
So why does someone here want to import dates?
It's a food source that's becoming more and more popular in restaurants and things like that. And again, most of those kinds of things, we get to work with entrepreneurs that were coming up with business ideas, finding a place to source that. And there's so much innovation and so much of that in the Kansas City region. We get to work with those all the time. So it's great to see them grow as well.
Do you think that people who live around here have a very clear sense of just how much is coming and going into and out of Kansas City to make commerce, I don't know, to make it flow, to make it work?
I think there's certainly an awareness. I think today's world that the youth expect that the company that they're doing with to be working on a global scale. And I think that we do an excellent job of that. We've got great supply chain courses and so forth at some of the universities around town. And I think that we promote that. I think that we could do better. I think that we need to do better as far as looking towards exporting our products. I think we do have a lot of innovation. And 95% of the world's consumers are outside our borders. So I think encouraging and motivating local businesses to think outside of the United States, whether it's Canada, Mexico, to sell our goods, I think will benefit trade in general.
Why do you think people don't do that as much?
Well, we've participated with the Global Cities Initiative, and we've learned a lot about why the consumers do and do not do those kinds of things. And most of the time, it's they don't know how. They don't know how to grow their product outside of the United States.
You know, I guess this is an old-fashioned way of thinking, but since we're not on an international border, I think maybe people don't think of Kansas City as having kind of a porous kind of commerce like that. You know what I mean? The nicknames for our city include things like Heart of America and stuff like that, which, I don't know, we are far from another country. We aren't a major, international port. You know what I mean?
Well, we are a major international port, to be honest with you. I mean, we Kansas City, the rail hub, we are the second largest rail hub in the nation to Chicago. We're number one if you include tonnage. And that's because we have so much grain and agricultural products exporting from our community. I don't think people know that we are, in fact, one of the largest rail hubs. And with our connectivity of highways with I-35, which runs right down into Mexico, right through Laredo into Mexico, and then on up into Canada, we actually are a major, major player in international trade.
Are you keeping a close eye on possible changes in trade policy?
Absolutely. Every day we're reading about new changes in policy. I just read this morning that there's a potential for an executive order to review all current free trade agreements.
And what does a person in your position think when reading an article such as that?
Well, for someone like me, because we are regulatory experts, it's our job to stay up on those regulations. Personally, that's going to require an in-depth conversation with all of our clients specifically that are taking part in free trade agreements, because we may need to reevaluate that to see if potentially their products still qualify for those benefits overseas when we export them.
A phrase like free trade, I mean, what are your thoughts about that, just that phrase?
Free trade, it gets a bad name. People don't quite understand it, what free is. Why should people be able to send goods to our country and be free? But the benefit is really for our exporters. And we live in the Midwest here, and we've got great agricultural products that we feed the world out of the Midwest, great grounds to grow product. And we actually need to be exporting. And in order to export into certain countries, the barrier to trade is much higher. For example, Brazil. Exporting into Brazil, their duties and taxes will often be over 50%, while importing that same product from Brazil into the United States, say it would be on average maybe 3%. So by entering into a free trade agreement, we're actually lowering our barrier by 3%. We're bringing their barrier down from 50 to zero. So we're actually gaining more in that free trade agreement. And we're opening up the potential for our farmers, our agriculture, to penetrate into those countries, which right now are barriered because of trade and taxes.
And you are under the impression that people see this in some other way?
Well, the rhetoric is always about free trade agreements and lost jobs. We're losing jobs to Mexico. We're losing jobs to China, which, by the way, there's no free trade agreement with China. So we didn't lose jobs to them because of free trade agreements. But that's often what comes around. But the statistics actually don't support that by any means at all. The statistics actually support that we've lost more jobs because of technology and advanced manufacturing than we had to have to free trade.
Well, hang on just a minute, Kevin. This is where I'd like to establish what exactly is happening with trade right now. Raj Bala, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And I should say I'm not speaking here on behalf of KU or the state of Kansas, a standard disclaimer. What is happening is an assault on the concept of free trade, and a great deal of turmoil and a lot of misinformation about what trade law and policy is all about.
So I want to let our listeners know who exactly they're hearing from when they're hearing from you, and using a strong word like that this is an assault, right? Raj is the Associate Dean for International and Comparative Law at KU. He's just made clear that he speaks, however, for himself. But perhaps more significantly, he has literally written the book on trade. He is the author of a textbook that gives a non-Western perspective on international trade law. So when you say that there is an assault on free trade, can you explain that a little more?
Yeah. Four things, if you will, are traded across borders. Goods, services, intellectual property, and people. And from some quarters, what we're hearing is we don't want any more of those items, those goods, those services, the IP, or the people. And in fact, we've had movement of all four items for decades, indeed centuries. And the idea of the assault is that we're attacking very underpinnings of our economy and indeed of our society and other societies. When we throw around terms like all trade should be fair, and we don't have a concept of what fairness is in trade. So we have to think through carefully what's really happening. And what's really happening is depending on what good, what service, what kind of intellectual property, or what person, there is more or less free trade. It's a continuum between utterly shutting down trade on the one hand, and then utterly opening the borders on the other hand. And there's no across-the-board free trade. It's managed trade depending on what good service, IP, or person you're talking about.
Yeah, when we talk, I mean, I guess the continuum from when you say shutting down trade to totally open trade, the opposite of open trade is shutting down, not just regulating?
Yeah, the polar opposites would be absolutely no trade, what trade people call autarky. And that just means that there are no imports, no exports. And the closest society to that now in the world would be North Korea. That is not a strong economic policy, as we all know. The most open trade societies would be countries like Singapore. The U.S. And other countries in the WTO, there are 164 of them, kind of fall on that continuum.
What is it that regulation in trade does accomplish?
Well, as Kevin very rightly pointed out, it accomplishes food safety, sanitary protections, phytosanitary protection for animals and plants as well as humans. It also accomplishes protection against weapons of mass destruction or bioterrorism being smuggled in. Some of you may have seen the movie Some of All Fears. That's a sort of a nightmare scenario. So we have strong regulations to protect against that.
Wait a minute. I did not see that movie, so I need you to tell me what this nightmare scenario is.
The nightmare scenario is the WMD being smuggled in on a container ship from overseas.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Exactly.
Because exactly. Just no one knows what's on that ship. No one cares.
Well, everyone cares, but we may not all know. Post 9/11, legal reforms included 100% container screening requirement, which Kevin knows very, very well. He has to deal with that every day. And the idea is sort of like people getting on airplanes, containers have to be scanned.
And take off their shoes.
Take off their shoes in an electronic sense. That's right. So that's one set of things that are coming. But another is technical standards. We want to make sure that the microphone we're using right now doesn't blow up in the studio. We don't want that to happen.
No, we don't.
So there are a lot of goals that you accomplish through trade regulation. You also want to make sure that the trade, and this gets back to your earlier point, that it really is fair. For example, the goods are not being dumped. They're not being illegally subsidized. They're not.
Why would those things be unfair?
Since as early as 1947, and in fact, even dating further back into the late 19th century, the world trading community has defined a category of behaviors, namely dumping and getting certain kinds of subsidies, as unfair. And it's given the countries are given the measures to take action against dumping and subsidies. And indeed, we do. The U.S. does that. And so it's one of the most active users of the anti-dumping and the anti-subsidy rules.
So Trump has called an end to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was one of his campaign promises. And in fact, taking a position on the TPP was a really important issue for both candidates. Could you refresh our memories by explaining what the TPP was?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is part of the assault that we talked about earlier. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a 12-nation agreement that was negotiated between 2008 and 2016. And it has 30 chapters, six of which deal directly with conventional trade issues, the kinds of issues we've been talking about. The balance, the remaining 24 chapters, deal with new trade issues like women and women's empowerment in trade, small and medium-sized enterprises, new kinds of intellectual property protection, disciplines on state-owned enterprises. This agreement was carefully crafted, albeit not transparently, and that's an issue we can come back to. And it's about 800 pages in its core text. It's about 6,000 pages when you add in all the side letters and annexes.
So not light reading.
Not light reading, but its fundamental goal was to move beyond NAFTA and move beyond the WTO agreements and bring the U.S. closer with its other 11 Asia-Pacific partners economically to try and liberalize trade, manage it a little bit less, make it a little bit freer. And also it had a national security dimension, and that was to write rules that would help discipline China as long as China is not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Some might use the word contain. And then if China were to join, China would be held to those rules that the U.S. and the other 11 partners had written.
So, and when you say to move beyond NAFTA, this is really like such common knowledge, but maybe everyone doesn't know. I mean, talk to me about where NAFTA had left us before the TPP.
Sure. Well, we're all familiar in our daily lives with contracts, with employment contracts, for example, contracts that we have to help out on lawn and garden or house matters. And contracts that go on for 20 years, they probably need updating. And trade rules are the same. There are many things that NAFTA didn't talk about or didn't talk about in depth. It didn't talk about, for example, new biologic medicines and whether or not the data that are used to get approval for those medicines should be held exclusively by the patent owner of those medicines. It didn't talk about, as I mentioned earlier, women and economic development. It had very limited provisions on state-owned enterprises. So the idea was to pull together, and Mexico, of course, is a TPP partner, as is Canada. They also agreed that we ought to try and use TPP to modernize the NAFTA rules.
And NAFTA, too. I mean, there's talk of renegotiation of NAFTA.
Yeah, there is. And the thing is, one answer to that is we already just did that. We spent about, if you do the calculation, and this is a very conservative estimate, about 1.2 million person hours of lawyer and analyst time across the 12 countries, across 8 years, updating NAFTA and our other free trade agreements.
So getting back to the TPP, how did opposition to this particular agreement gain, and the United States' role in it, gain so much political traction?
Misinformation and the lack of transparency. I mean, first of all, during the previous administration, the only way you were going to find out about TPP, if you actually wanted to access WikiLeaks, and I definitely did not, just want to make that clear, was to wait for the WikiLeaks uploading. So it was hard to find out what was going on. And in that space,
fear, not knowing what's going on.
Exactly. And then a second big thing was a failure to communicate that the causes of adjustment costs from trade, that is losing jobs or suffering income, was really about 80% of those costs were not due to trade. They weren't due to NAFTA or the WTO. They were due to technological development, information technology, lack of human capital.
Well, was something lost in the termination of this agreement?
A lot was lost. Aside from the sheer work that was put in, the U.S. leadership in the Asia-Pacific region just a few days ago, all other 11 Trans-Pacific partners, along with China, Korea, and Colombia, met in Chile to decide a path forward, possibly taking TPP without the Americans, or possibly moving forward on a Chinese-led initiative, which goes by the acronym of the RCEP.
What is different for me now if I am an importer or exporter in the United States?
Well, case specific. If you're a beef exporter from Kansas, you're losing $400,000 a day to Australian competitors in the Japanese market because the Australians have a margin of preference, a tariff benefit. They face lower tariffs on their beef exporters than do ours from the U.S. That's just one example. In my case, as a teacher, I lose opportunities to go to the other 11 TPP countries under liberalized trade and service rules and offer my services.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we're going to hear what our rural friends and neighbors have to say about trade deals under the Trump administration. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about Kansas City's role in international trade. Let's pay a quick visit now to a rural community in Nebraska to get a sense of what's at stake for our agrarian and small-town neighbors. Harvest Public Media went to Dawson County because Donald Trump won a big majority there. But even though many of the people there are Trump supporters, they don't necessarily agree with the president on trade. Here's what Grant Gerlach has to say. He's with a 58-year-old farmer who's staring down the prospect of losing money this year.
Don Beatty supports President Trump, even though he knows Trump's trade proposals could spell more trouble for the struggling farm economy. We step into a farm shed where he tells me what his business needs is higher commodity prices. One way to do that is more trade.
That is one of the concerns that I and many of my fellow farmers have with the Trump administration is what he's been saying on trade. You know, he wants to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement. He vetoed or canceled the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Many voters saw the TPP as a path to outsourcing, but it would have made American farm exports cheaper in much of Asia. And then there's President Trump's campaign proposal to put big tariffs on Chinese imports. China is a huge market for U.S. farmers, so they worry about a trade war.
I am a free trader. That means that I think we ought to be able to sell our goods to other countries. They ought to be able to sell their goods to us.
But then on the other side of Dawson County, there's Junior Dishman. He likes where President Trump is going with trade.
I'll take you to the far side. We'll just go around. It kind of looks like a bomb went off right now.
Dishman is driving me to the edge of Cozad, a small city in Dawson County, to see what's left of the former Tenneco factory. He worked at the factory for 40 years, making shock absorbers, mostly for car companies. Now it's demolished. A salvage company is combing through piles of bricks and insulation to pull out scraps of steel and copper. Dishman looks out from under his black cowboy hat and points out a landmark in the rubble.
There's a pile over there. I think the desk is still there with the keys still laying on the desk. They just knocked it down on top of it.
Like farmer Don Beatty, Junior Dishman voted for Trump. But those import tariffs that Beatty is worried about, Dishman thinks they could help American workers compete with cheap labor overseas.
If they do start charging, let's say, China and all them tariffs and things for bringing their product back in, the cost will offset and then they can get jobs back in here.
Dishman knows farming is the biggest industry around Cozad, but Tenneco was the town's biggest single employer. At one time, he says, 750 people worked here in a town of around 4,000. He says many young families followed jobs out of town. Older workers with deeper roots stayed.
But they had to take a hit in their wages and in the insurance, and it affected the town quite a bit. It really did. It was like a lifeline here. It was a heartbeat, I think.
He doesn't want to see farmers suffer, but a lot of small towns have factories like this, and he wants to see them stay open. That's what makes trade policy difficult. Even when people here agree on most things, trade involves trade-offs.
That was Grant Gerlach for Harvest Public Media, who tells us that trade involves trade-offs, at least in rural America. Raj Bala, can you explain to me why trade deals are likely to affect farmers and factory workers differently, or are they? I mean, that seems to be the perception.
Yeah, well, the Tenneco factory story is one of the many heart-rending stories that really does need to be addressed. And the standard way of addressing it, which we have to take more seriously, in my own opinion, is trade adjustment assistance. I mean, the workers who lost their job and suffered the income declines and were outsourced are supposed to be getting some kind of assistance from the federal through the state governments. And that's been a standard policy ever since President Kennedy's Trade Expansion Act in 1962. And since then, the trade adjustment assistance has generally been a little less generous and not helping those workers retool to compete. It's also important to be straight with these workers. The idea that a tariff on Chinese goods will raise the cost of those Chinese goods to offset the disadvantage American goods face is somewhat of a myth. Already, Chinese labor manufacturing costs are about 85% of those of the United States. And if the Chinese were to face tariffs coming into the United States, they will do what they are already starting to do, and that is move their factories to cheaper locations in Laos or in Cambodia. That's simply the nature of capitalism, to understand that movement of factories and the constant shifting of labor costs is never going to assure a long-term comparative advantage. And so the way to deal with that is to help the workers retool into higher value-added products. And even if those jobs were to come back, we should also be straight with the workers. They're going to come back and be performed by robots.
Wow. Well, In the Midwest, in a small town in the Midwest, what you are primarily going to find is people who have a stake in either agriculture or manufacturing. And it sounds from listening to this piece like how agriculture is going to fare in a trade agreement, how a farmer might fare would be very different from how someone who relies on a manufacturing job might fare. Is that reality? Are these two things just filling such different roles, or what?
It's even within agriculture, it's sector specific. Because, for example, Kansas agriculture does quite well with beef and wheat, but winter vegetables in Florida, tomatoes, peppers, They have been suffering from competition from Mexico since NAFTA. So you have to look at each good. And even within manufacturing, Kevin gave you an excellent example that Garmin is quite successful. So it really depends. And then I would also push back a little bit on the services, because Kansas City is home to some of the world's great service providers in engineering, in architecture, for example.
And how are those affected by trade deals?
Well, they are actually benefited by deals like TPP and the WTO agreements, because their services can be traded by supplying them electronically, by having a bricks and mortar operation, by customers coming right to their doors, all sorts of ways that they can deliver their services.
Well, let's turn to a farmer a little closer to home in Kansas, Adam Baldwin. Hi, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you relate to the tension we just heard between this farmer and this factory worker in rural America?
Oh, I think I can understand it. And I would probably agree with Raj in talking about, I think in general, when we view exports and loss of jobs in the agriculture industry, we're going to be looking at it as the reality of that mechanization is where a lot of those jobs have went.
In farming, too?
Sorry, what was that?
In farming, too?
Well, yeah, that's what I was actually just going to mention. I can give you two examples. So as labor is becoming harder to find for dairies, which is primarily a lot of dairies use immigrant labor, as that's getting tougher to find, they're having robot milkers now that will milk a cow, that can train them to where they don't need someone there to hook up the milking machine. On my farm, as a personal example, I just had a neighbor retire, and I picked up half his ground, and another neighbor picked up the other half. So through the technology we have available today, we're just able to perform that much more work.
And you didn't have to hire anyone to do that, to help you with it?
Not at this point. If we picked up much more, we would need to.
So tell me more about your farm, just so that we know what kind of farm we're talking about.
Well, I'm a very typical central Kansas farm. We had been historically about 50% wheat, the balance being corn, sorghum, and soybeans. With the current wheat market being very poor, we've reduced our wheat to about a third, and then the balance is corn, sorghum, and soybeans. With the current soybean price, we're going to be mostly soybeans, and I think that's very typical.
Why is the wheat market poor?
Well, we produced too much of it. We had a couple record years in a row, and we have a high U.S. dollar, so that makes exporting that much tougher, and it's just kind of stacking up on us, and it's the old supply and demand. We have a lot more supply than the demand that's out there.
Do you know where your crops go, like, geographically? Could you tell me about the journey that, say, like, your soy takes after it leaves your farm?
Well, I could, and on soybeans, we're going to harvest it, and it's going to go to, we're going to take it to a local elevator. It'll probably be then either shipped to a soybean processing plant in Wichita, where they'll make soybean meal or soy oil, or it'll be exported by rail, probably down to the Gulf or to the West Coast. And depending on where it ends up, it'll most likely go to China. 40% of our beans are exported. A majority of the beans are going to be used in livestock. And so if you look at how much of our meat is exported, it's going to be exported potentially in the form of meat.
So what was your reaction to the dissolution of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Is that something that affected you and your sense of how your business, how your farm was going to be strongest?
Oh, it was frustrated. And I guess expect it to happen. But as Raj mentioned, $400,000 a day of lost income in an industry that's already losing money in general. And if you look at the meat exports, they're going to be eating corn or sorghum or soybeans. And so if any way we can increase demand is going to benefit the entire agricultural industry. And I think a lot of people in rural America, when you look at Trump trade policy and how they voted, they're maybe frustrated with with regulations, and they would use regulations as justification for voting for Donald Trump. And on my farm, I can deal with regulations that currently exist or that could happen, but I can't. I have to have a price for my grain that's above cost of production if I'm going to be staying in business.
Do you see a connection between trade as you experience it and trade as city folk experience it, like city folk even as nearby as Kansas City?
Well, I think as a farmer, we're going to be more directly impacted by trade. Just if we have a supply and demand report come out from the USDA, the value of my corn crop could go up or down 10% based on if exports were exceeded expectations or were below expectations. So I have a true in my wallet once a month, obvious what exports are doing for us. But I think I think we all have to realize we're benefiting from trade. And does the city guy see it as easy? I don't know.
Well, let's see. Kevin Ekstrand with us from a Kansas City company that helps move cargo through importing and exporting. Tell me how what you do connects with what Adam does. Is trade in Kansas City still connected with agriculture, even though our Board of Trade no longer has a big sculpture of wheat over the door?
Absolutely. You know, I can relate to Adam, you know, and he mentioned a bumper crop, you know, for the last couple of years and in wheat and so forth. And in the Midwest specifically, you know, there's a disproportionate amount of exports to imports. And sometimes our exporters actually struggled in this last summer because of all the production and getting enough containers to actually export their goods, which was tough as well. And I could see that even being tougher, you know, with free trade agreements to open up additional markets. We would certainly need to find a way to meet their need for the export community compared to the import side.
Adam, if you got to create your own trade policy that would be, in your mind, good for farms, good for farmers, what would be in it that you don't maybe hear people talking about?
Well, I think the biggest thing with trade is that when it works right, everyone should be a winner. And if I can sell my crops to someone in a foreign country that they can more effectively use their product and then, for instance, a swine farmer or a hog farmer in China. If he can use my sorghum and have a reliable product to feed his pigs that is going to be consistent as opposed to the Chinese corn crop, which is a little lower quality in storage, but they're trying to work through, then he wins. He has a better supply of feed for his herd, and I win because I have a good market. And I think if you can find the win-wins, yeah, it's not going to all be even, but I think in the end, if we can find that common ground, I think we all will win.
Adam Baldwin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adam's been talking to us from his farm in McPherson, Kansas. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from the author of our region's first export plan. She's the director of the World Trade Center of Kansas City, and we will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking with a lot of different people about their experiences and perspectives with international trade here in and around Kansas City. Now let's talk to Ivory Karamitros. She's the director of the World Trade Center of Kansas City. Good morning, Ivory.
Good morning, Gina.
So talk to me about your own background. When did you first remember taking an interest in trade? Does it go, I mean, it's, it sounds like it goes back a long way.
Yes. So, well, obviously, throughout your childhood, you have a lot of toys that are manufactured overseas. And I remember when labeling became a law and a legal requirement and how it was on all your toys and your clothes. And I remember talking to my parents about that. But in terms of trade and when it hit more home for me was when our family literally moved from Fort Worth, Texas, and we moved to China.
Why?
To Shenyang, China. So my parents both teach English, and they help out with universities and students who are interested in studying abroad, and all those sorts of great people who want to travel or study abroad and those sorts of things. So we lived in Shenyang, China, city of 8 million, moved there in 2001. I graduated high school there. I went to an international school, but, I was very much immersed in the community. And I had never been, to any other country other than Mexico, because Texas is pretty close to Mexico. But, China was, definitely the longest travel I've ever taken. And then getting there, I remember when there weren't all that many cars on the road. And now when I go back, I just am astounded at what they've been able to do in just 15 years. It's unbelievable. And trade is absolutely the reason why that has happened. And, when I look back on that and then whenever I had graduated college in 2008, it was at a time, December 2008, so the economy had obviously been suffering, and a lot of folks like that were my age that had graduated, there were absolutely no options really for us at that time because, unemployment was in double digits, companies were laying off people, all the job prospects I had lined up were gone, and I just remember thinking, like, what am I going to do? And obviously, I had my language background, but and I had my business degree and my political science degree, but I wasn't exactly sure where I saw myself in the job market. And I had to decide for myself, how am I going to be competitive? What is my competitive advantage as opposed to other people that are in the workforce? And that is obviously the tenets of economics, especially as you talk about Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations. So I had to take a little bit of that and apply it to my own life. And from that, I was able to determine how I wanted to be in international trade. And now I'm here in Kansas City. But there were several other steps, obviously, in between there that helped me be able to get here.
How would you say that lens, your experience living in China, living in the place where the sticker tells us so many of our goods are from, how do you think that gives you maybe a different lens in looking at international trade?
Well, trade, like we heard from a lot of our friends that were on, the air that were in the farming industry, it helps everyone when it's done right. Whenever I moved to Shenyang, unemployment in that city was at 25%. I remember going to school, and on every corner, there were day laborers that would be holding signs that would say, all the different skills they had in terms of a factory or what they could do agriculturally or what they could do construction-wise. And I remember seeing that as I would go back, so I graduated high school, and then I would come back, every summer or so, and you would see that thinning. You would see that kind of almost go away. And not to say that it's not, that they're now this shining jewel of an economy or whatever in that city right now. But my point is it's much better. And so there everyone wins when trade is done right.
So what, you work here for the World Trade Center of Kansas City. What does a World Trade Center of a city do?
So essentially because the World Trade Center Network, our headquarters is in New York, so the World Trade Center Association, there are 330 World Trade Centers in over 100 different countries. So that helps Kansas City and our business community because we represent Kansas City's business community, and we serve our business community. We are able to help introduce and make connections to other World Trade Centers for our members and for our business community throughout the world. And then we also have reciprocity with those other World Trade Centers. If they're interested in exporting some of their product or if they're looking for someone, a distributor, to represent their product here in Kansas City, we are able to help them do that.
Can you give me an example of a connection that you have witnessed coming together? Because I think still, my sense of where Kansas City fits into a global commerce is a little shaky.
Sure. So, there's a company here in Kansas City that They are part of the automation process as it relates to car manufacturing. And through our efforts, through our export plan, we have something called the Export Concierge. And what this is, it's a free service to any Kansas City company or really any sort of regional business that's interested in exporting that maybe they don't know how to get started. And Kevin was talking about that a little bit, about how, like, why aren't there more exporting? Why isn't more exporting happening in Kansas City? And it's really just because whenever we, like, actually got into the data, 10 months worth of research in 2015, we learned that Kansas City companies aren't exporting because they're just really not thinking about it, or they don't know how to get started. And so with this Export Concierge service, just recently we were able to work with this company and introduce them to a variety of export resources, and now they're exporting to Canada in the millions of dollars. And that helps keep jobs here in Kansas City. And if we didn't have the service at the World Trade Center, where would they have gone? You know, it's really that simple. We need to think locally, but also think globally.
So Kansas City now has an export plan, and you wrote it.
Well, I helped write that. It was a huge effort with a lot of people. Kevin was on our committee. We had a lot of people who did a lot of hard work.
But what's in that plan? I mean, what do people in Kansas City, what should we know about that?
Essentially, it really, the shining jewel is this Export Concierge service, because that's very tangible. But we also want to help, you know, entrepreneurs think globally. We want to have our ecosystem of export assistance providers to be more connected, and that we're communicating with each other about, like, oh, you're working with the same client. Oh, that's great. What are you working on? How are they doing? You know, those sorts of very simple, you know, sort of practical, tangible aspects that you can do as a community thinks about how are we going to join together and represent our community internationally.
So how do international trade deals and their dissolution affect the work that you are trying to do?
It affects it a lot. So, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we're processing certificates of origin. So that's saying, you know, where a product is from, and we certify that document and its export documentation. Kevin knows all about that as well, because they have those. But with free trade agreements, you know, they have their own types of certificates of origin. But not only that, but, you know, it's a great selling point whenever we talk to a company and we're giving consultation to them. You know, hey, you've never exported before. How about you try Canada? We have a free trade agreement. They speak English. It's a great first, you know, learning sort of process for them. It's that first, you know, kind of kindergarten sort of, you know, classroom style, you know. And then once they master that, then it's Mexico. And then it's, you know, the world just really kind of becomes their oyster at that point. And I believe at this point we still have, what, 18 different trade agreements. So, you know, it just really kind of becomes much more easier. And in Australia, we have a free trade agreement with them. So, you know, it, Canada, then Australia. You know what I mean? It's just kind of one of those things that it suddenly becomes a very, very easy process for them.
When you think about something like the possible renegotiation of NAFTA, I mean, how do you see something like that affecting Kansas City specifically? What does Kansas City specifically stand to gain or lose?
Well, I mean, Canada and Mexico are our two largest export markets whenever we talk about Kansas City. And so what we stand to lose if it's renegotiated in an area that would be detrimental to us, and maybe in terms of like automobile manufacturing or auto parts, those sorts of things, you know, would be locally would affect a lot of our jobs, essentially, a lot of our companies. And maybe they would even think about where they are in terms of, you know, their domestic placement in the United States. So, you know, we hope to see that, you know, there's some advancements if there's a renegotiation, you know, like Raj was saying. But, you know, like in areas of like energy, telecommunications, technology, those sorts of areas that we've seen a lot of advancement in the last 20 years. But then there's other areas that are still, you know, kind of tried and true. And if it's not broken, you know, it's kind of, you know, those sorts of conversations that we need to have. And we would hope that, and as Raj was saying earlier, like it would be kind of a transparent process. So people know what they're getting into.
The people who you are interacting with, who are coming to you for your expertise, they're not trade experts.
Correct.
They're looking to benefit from your understanding. What do you think are some of the biggest misunderstandings about these deals that you see, maybe even as a result of political rhetoric?
I have to hear the music, so I don't know what it... What was the question? I'm sorry.
Just the biggest misunderstandings you encounter.
Oh, they think that it's really difficult. They think it's really hard. And, you know, if you get to kind of just learn the process in general, it's just rinse and repeat at that point. And if you have a great freight forwarder, they'll help you all along the way.
Ivory Karametros, director of the World Trade Center of Kansas City, thank you.
Thank you.
Raj Bala, with us from KU School of Law, author of the textbook on international trade, the only one. Thank you.
Thank you.
We also spoke with farmer Adam Baldwin and importer-exporter Kevin Ekstrand of Scarborough International. You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, country music legend Patsy Cline played her very last show in Kansas City. That was in March of 1963. So a young musician will be reminiscing with us about what Patsy Cline means to her. And if you were at the show, you can call us up tomorrow. We'll be talking about that at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. Special thanks to KMUW in Wichita for help with today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.